What actually happens is you'll notice that people, when they get into college, when they get into university, they really struggle with being able to organize themselves and so on and so forth. Like, it really shows within childhood. And I remember being younger and going, there's something there. There is something there, which is really, like, it's making me struggle. And I'm finding myself so frustrated in my own brain. And people didn't believe me. And whether it was because there was a lack of education around the time, so on and so forth, like, seeing how it affected my childhood and how I grew up and how I have arguably, like, some level of educational trauma from it, from not being believed and being left in the dark without the support that I needed, was a real struggle, you know. And we can speak about losing things and so on and so forth, but it's so multifaceted and it presents so differently in so many people that we will all be on that spectrum, but not everyone will fit into the category. Each person will present even slightly differently.
Does it make you hyper?
Oh, can you tell I'm talking really fast right now? I'm currently at my work walking around the office because I'm not able to sit still. I have moments where I feel like real energy surges and I get like up and I'm bouncing and I'm moving and then I crash really hard. It's quite a constant thing, the constant ups and the downs and the confusion. And it's a constant need for balance, which I know we talk about medication, which is what the medication is supposed to bring when it's available.
You're on to talk about queuing up for a pint or something, Emily, but I actually think this is a lot more interesting if you're cool with it. Talking to you about this. I used to go when I was in my early 20s. I'm 51 now. I'm an old man now. But when I was in my early 20s, I used to go to a summer camp in America, where there were all these American kids would come into the summer camp and there were counselors from around the world. Why am I saying this? Because lots of these American kids were diagnosed to have ADHD, and the parents, when they were going to the summer camp, would take them off their medication. Ritalin, I remember it was called. And the reason I ask you, does it make you hyper? These kids off their medication would be bouncing off the wall hyper. And I remember this thinking, the parents are medicating these children and then taking them off, obviously, that necessary medication in the summer. So without medication, to some people with ADHD, Emily, is it exhausting?
So one thing I want to point out with that is that there is a lot to say about being younger and having hyperactivity. And I think there was a big conversation around misdiagnosis of people when, for example, even I was younger, you know, there was a level of, I don't want this to be a harmful comment because I recognize that this is not something that I've experienced because I got diagnosed last November. But there is a conversation to be had about symptoms that are presented and making sure people were diagnosed correctly. And we speak about overdiagnosis and we speak about underdiagnosis. And it's just a constant, again, balance to find. And if I'm being totally honest with you, I think that without my medication, I have found that I have struggled 1,000 times more than I could have ever struggled with it. I noticed what my life was like with the medication versus without, and it's just been a constant.
What does it do? Does it take the edge off the hyperactivity, or what does it do? Does it calm your brain down? What does it do?
It's a stimulant. I believe it's a stimulant. So it's the same with things, and maybe not to the same extent because they're not targeted and not specific drugs for this, but it's the same with coffee. So there's a conversation to be had about, and I know research being done in regards to people who with ADHD, and drinking coffee and how it doesn't give you that buzz that it would give most people. It's the same with the medication in that it just levels you. It levels you, it calms your brain, it gives you clarity. It's not one of those things that it fixes everything. You still need to put processes in place. But again, it creates clarity and understanding and just makes everything slightly more focused, you know?
And how, finally, Lorelai, how do they diagnose you? Like, how do you get a diagnosis of what's happening inside your brain? Like, does this, for example, show up on a brain scan?
Yeah, I mean, it's very different in this country, but I first read a book about it that talks about it. It's an American doctor and it has brain scans in it. And that's what made me suspect, oh, this is interesting. I know, but I actually had some tests done in Melbourne because I got tested in the in London, and they initially said it wasn't ADD and I had anxiety, and said it wasn't that because I, you know, because I'd held down a job and had book published, but they said you'd be on that windowsill because I wasn't displaying hyperactivity, and I don't seem that hyper or ADD, you know. He was like, he just was like, you don't tick the boxes, I'm sorry. But then I actually went to Melbourne and had some tests done, where they do an attention test. It's on a computer and you do all these, press all these buttons, and then they do it with Ritalin, with the stimulant, and you score much higher. You know, it shows.
Okay.
It literally tests for, you know, how my attention speed was very, very poor before, and then it was much better afterwards.
And finally, Emily, is it a symptom of ADHD to develop obsession-like focus? Do you get obsessed with things and you stay on it and you can't get away from it?
I'm sure Lorelei can agree. Hyperfixations are a daily occurrence. Yeah. My hyperfixation at the moment is this wonderful sort of caramel syrup that I want in everything that I drink, and I have so much of it. And also, I've just picked up painting. That is what my hyperfixations are at the moment.
Yeah.
So that is where I am right now. But yes, hyperfixations, yeah, everything.
Very much possible in the world of people as well, and you can hyperfixate on people. And so the world of romance, yes, is very complicated with ADD. You get kind of rejection sensitivity dysphoria, so you get people overreact a little bit more.
That's interesting.
But I call it
so you get obsessed with people, do you?
I call it attention dating disorder, because you're like, you can't, it's not. Yeah, I think you can feel like you're falling in love, but I think, actually, is this just my prefrontal cortex getting stuck? You know,
it's like... That's not very romantic, is it? I really fancy this person. Dopamine. Let's talk about my prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, I don't know if it's misplaced dopamine or I'm really in love. I don't know, but yeah, I think it definitely is something to think about, the science behind it.
I think this is such an interesting conversation. I really do. Thank you for having it with me, Lorelei. Emily, much more interesting than... Are people still queuing up at a pub, in my view? So thank you for embracing this conversation. I'm sure we'll talk about queuing up in the pub at some other time, Emily, but thank you for that tonight. Here's our number, 0808 509 693. Maybe you've been diagnosed with ADHD. You can pick up the phone to us. We're late with the news, but here it comes now from the BBC.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Israel is carrying out fresh attacks in southern Beirut, targeting sites where it says Hezbollah is storing weapons. The Israeli military has told people to evacuate a number of buildings in the Lebanese capital. A series of buildings have already been levelled in the area. Israel says it hit Hezbollah headquarters. The Lebanese authorities say 6 people have died and more than 90 have been wounded. Tributes to Dame Maggie Smith, who died earlier today at the age of 89, have described her as fierce, witty and one of the true greats. She was best known for her roles in Downton Abbey and the Harry Potter films. Gary Oldman, who played Sirius Black in the Harry Potter series, described her as a dazzling talent. The actor Sir Michael Palin starred alongside her in multiple films, including the comedies The Missionary and A Private Function. He told the BBC what it was like to work with her.
She was just a marvellous, instinctively gifted actor. And being with her, you just knew that you always had an uphill task to stay with her. And if you got it right and if you played it well together, it was a wonderful experience. She was really good to work with. But as I say, one had to keep up to the mark.
2 13-year-old boys have been given life sentences with a minimum term of 8.5 years for stabbing to death a man with a machete. Sean Caesar High was stabbed in Wolverhampton last year. The boys were aged 12 at the time of the attack. Donald Trump has said he would quickly resolve the conflict between Russia and Ukraine if he wins the US presidential election in November. While meeting President Zelensky in New York, Mr. Trump said he had a good relationship with the leaders of both sides.
I think the president said it the best. This is a war that should have never happened. It should have never happened, and it wouldn't have happened. It's a shame, and we'll get it solved. It's a complicated puzzle, very complicated puzzle, but we'll get it solved.
Controversial plans to build 29 new tennis courts in Wimbledon have been approved. Local residents are concerned about the damage it might do to protected open land. Our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller reports.
The All England Club wants to build these new courts and an 8,000-seater stadium on the former site of Wimbledon Park Golf Club. The extra courts would allow Wimbledon qualifying to take place on site and prevent the championships falling behind the other Grand Slams, in the words of the club chair Deborah Jevons. Local residents and politicians fighting the proposal are now running out of options, but could still apply for a judicial review. They had been hoping that Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner would decide to hold a fresh hearing, but a letter sent to protesters, which has been seen by the BBC, makes clear she believes the application should be determined at a local level.
And the weather dry and clear for most, except in western Scotland, a risk of some showers in Wales and Northern Ireland.
Football on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Listen to exclusive live commentaries from the Premier League, Champions League and more with the 5 Live Sport team.
He's been on the pitch for 10 seconds. Thank you very much.
Stay on top of everything football every day with the Football Daily Podcast.
This is the best central defensive partnership in European football.
His confidence levels are through the roof.
Football on 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Tonight on The Nolan Show, we've been talking about the following stories. Israel says it's bombarded what it called Hezbollah's central headquarters in Beirut. As part of a series of strikes, Iran's foreign minister has said it will stand by Lebanon by all means. Gina Abercrombie Winstanley is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a former US ambassador.
Iran has acted like the adult in the room, quite frankly, over this last year. They have communicated with the United States and others what they were going to do when they felt the need to retaliate for an attack by Israel. Much of the escalation has happened from the Israeli side.
The COVID-19 public inquiry has been taking place this week. Dr. Paul Thimu is a spokesperson and ambassador for Doctors in Distress, and he shared some of his worst memories of the pandemic.
One of the most distressing things to see is someone not able to catch their breath and essentially suffocating. You can see the fear in their eyes, and you have the fear yourself that you can do very little, and it's one of the worst things to see.
And people with ADHD say they're still struggling to get hold of their medication. It comes a year on from when the shortage started. Lorelei Mathias is an author, comedian and creator of the online comedy show Life in ADHD.
So I generally try to ration what I have got just because I don't know that I'll definitely get each month the amount that I need. So, and also sharing with friends and just in regular contact with friends who are on similar things. People have been sending messages to my Instagram saying, I've got spares because I've titrated onto a different thing. So if you need anyone, if anyone needs Elvance, I've got some, which is really lovely.
The headlines tomorrow, The Times, tuition fees to rise, but grants return too. The Guardian, Israel launches heaviest air attacks on Lebanon. The Daily Mail, Boris's dramatic plan for military raid on Holland to snatch back our vaccines. Here's how to get in touch.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms for our terms of use and privacy notice. Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
The paper's coming up shortly. Before that, Omar Al-Fayed, the son of Mohammed Al-Fayed, has released a public statement in the wake of allegations of sexual abuse made against his late father. Dozens of women have accused the former Harrods owner, who died last year, aged 94, of multiple rapes and sexual assaults. Lawyers hoping to bring a case against the department store are now representing 60 women after a BBC investigation revealed the claims of over 20 women last week. BBC reporter Simon Jones is with us tonight. What has the son of Mohammed Al-Fayed, Omar, been saying, Simon?
Well, Stephen, it's more than a week since the BBC released the documentary Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Until now, we hadn't heard from Mohamed Al Fayed's family, but that has now changed. His son, Omar, has released a statement. He posted it on Instagram, and he said he's horrified by the allegations. He said his late father had been a wonderful dad, but he added that this did not blind him from what he called an objective assessment of circumstances. I'll just read you a little bit of the statement. Further, he says the extent and explicit nature of the allegations are shocking and has thrown into question the loving memory I had of him. How this matter could have been concealed for so long and in so many ways raises further disturbing questions. He goes on to say throughout history, people in positions of power have all too often been shielded from the consequences of their actions, and justice has frequently been delayed or denied to those who have suffered. I firmly believe that anyone found guilty of such reprehensible actions, including having had facilitated, enabled, or helped cover up such actions, no matter their status, must be held accountable. He goes on to say that the alleged victims deserve full transparency and accountability, and he expressed his support for any legitimate investigation into these allegations, saying, "I will continue to support the principles of truth, justice, accountability, and fairness, regardless of where that journey may lead." But he also, in his statement, criticised the BBC for its extensive reporting on the allegations.
What was the criticism?
I think he says the BBC should get its house in order, given that the BBC has had some scandals in recent times. So he seems to be supporting the women coming forward and looking at those allegations, but I think he feels that the BBC perhaps is making too much of it.
What role did he have, Mohamed Al Fayed's son, Omar, have in the business empire?
Well, Omar's now 36 years old. He's an environmental entrepreneur, and he was appointed to the board of Harrods Directors in 2006, and he remained on that board until his father sold the business in 2010. Now, as regards Harrods, the department store's current owners have said repeatedly that they're utterly appalled by the allegations. They've condemned the actions of Mohamed Al Fayed in the strongest possible terms, and they acknowledge that during the time Harrods was owned by him, as a business, it failed its employees who were his victims, and it has apologised for that.
And where are we on the investigation into what happened?
Well, it's pretty fast moving. Lawyers hoping to bring a case against Harrods say they're now representing 60 women, and they say they have been contacted by far more who say they also have been victims of Mohamed Al Fayed. Now, they say that he preyed on young women hired by the company, threatening them against speaking out about his behaviour. Now, Mohamed Al Fayed is dead, so the police cannot bring a case against him. But the Metropolitan Police have said they will explore if anyone else should be pursued for criminal offences. The Met has urged anyone who hasn't come forward yet to contact them, and it has promised to review historic complaints. And the Force said earlier this week it had identified 19 allegations which it had received against Al Fayed, reported to the Met between 2005 and 2023. So quite a long period of time, but he was never taken to court. And a further part of the investigation, Al Fayed also owned Fulham Football Club for 16 years. And Fulham have told us they remain in the process of establishing whether anyone at the club is or has been affected by the report. Reports concerning Al Fayed, and the Football Association says it's aware of the reports and will remain in contact with Fulham FC. So a number of different investigations taking place, but we have finally heard from the Al Fayed family now.
Simon Jones, thank you very much indeed. 17 minutes past midnight, 5 Live from the BBC. It's the Nolan Show. Time to look through tomorrow morning's newspapers now. The front pages with Emma Burnell, political commentator. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello there, and Reem Ibrahim tonight from the Institute for Economic Affairs. Hello, Reem.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Shall we start in this story? I know we read there that it was in the Daily Mail. It also is appearing in the Daily Telegraph tomorrow. Similar story. I'll read the Telegraph headline. Boris's war cry in COVID, invade Holland. I'll read the first couple of paragraphs. Boris Johnson considered invading the Netherlands to seize COVID vaccines during the height of the pandemic, he has revealed. Writing in his memoir, to be published next month, the former Prime Minister said he commissioned the armed forces to consider if an aquatic raid on a warehouse in Leiden was possible. The depot contained 5 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, which Mr. Johnson believed were rightfully British because they were developed in the UK. But he was told the plan was unlikely to succeed, and he was forced to admit that the idea of effectively invading a NATO ally was not Emma.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, good God. I mean, I know Boris likes to stay.
The point
the
here, I know it's, I know it, I know you're giggling, but the point here is this was the Prime Minister at the time of COVID contemplating this.
I know, and that's the scary part, isn't it? I mean, we can laugh now, but he was in charge of our country, and that's a sad, sad joke. I mean, yeah, it's a NATO country. The Prime Minister does have the authority to call a war, but I think that, frankly, the officials around him, however poor they were at sometimes controlling his behaviour, would have absolutely literally sat on him in order to stop him invading a NATO country. But I just, this just feels like yet more desperate attempt to stay in the limelight. I know this.
Well,
is
he's serialising his book. To be fair, isn't he? The Daily Mail is serialising his book. He's making money out of it. That's what people do when they write books.
Indeed, and I'm sure this will be just as reliable a narrative as such luminaries as Nadine Dorries' book as well.
I think it's so interesting. I mean, I completely agree with Emma, but I also think that there is the added layer to this where effectively, yes, you know, Johnson is very clearly trying to remain relevant. He's effectively trying to sell his book. I, however, don't believe the story. I don't believe it's true. I don't believe that Boris Johnson genuinely wanted to invade a NATO country like the Netherlands. And I don't believe that he thought that just because the AstraZeneca vaccine had been developed in the United Kingdom, that those particular vaccines were rightfully ours. There was a bit of a question about those particular vaccines. I remember the story during the pandemic, but it's effectively a non-story. And I don't think that this is genuine. So I do think it's fine to laugh about it. And I don't think that Johnson would have ever genuinely wanted to invade the Netherlands.
Well, there's a deputy chief of the defence staff, Lieutenant General Doug Chalmers, quoted in the Daily Telegraph tomorrow. Well, something is attributed to what his thinking was, which is different. So I'll read the paragraph. Lieutenant General Doug Chalmers, the Deputy Chief of the Defence Staff, told him such action, invading the Netherlands, was certainly feasible. He explained how he would do it, Mr. Johnson wrote. And this is according to Boris Johnson. I think that's important for us to stress. We would send one team on a commercial flight to Amsterdam, while another team would use the cover of darkness to cross the channel in ribs, those are rigid inflatable boats, and navigate up the canals. They would then rendezvous at the target, enter, secure the hostage goods, that's the vaccines, exfiltrate using an articulated lorry, and make their way to the channel ports. But I have to warn you, and they all looked up at me meaningfully, Boris Johnson writes, that it will not be possible to do this undetected. And he pointed out that there were lockdowns in place in Belgium and the Netherlands, and the local authorities might observe our movements. If we're detected, we'll have to explain why we're effectively invading a long-standing NATO ally. Like, you could not make this up, Emma.
Well, I mean, I think Reem raises an interesting point. Either Boris Johnson is mad, and seriously consider what sounds like the plot of a dreadful B movie, or he's lying. And those seem to be the two options. And Boris, this is coming from Boris's own book. So when Reem says she doesn't believe it, I mean, I absolutely agree with her that it's extremely unlikely to have ever taken place. But whether Boris Johnson himself considered it and considered it enough to consider it important enough to be part of his mad memoirs, clearly he did.
I think it was probably a joke. I think it was probably one of those situations where, and I think that maybe a lot of people at home can relate to this, where you'll be at work and there'll be a problem and you sort of say, well, why don't we just do this? Why don't we just go in and do this? And effectively, you come out with some kind of outrageous, very, very silly potential solution. And clearly, you know, if we, you know, if we're looking at it from a realistic perspective, or sorry, from a non-realistic perspective, yes, the British military could certainly go into the Netherlands. It would be feasible to go into the Netherlands, invade NATO country, and get back those vaccines. But would you ever?
I mean, I've made jokes at work. My colleagues might tell you I make far too many. I'm also never, ever going to write my memoirs, which I think we can all be grateful for. But I wouldn't put some dumb joke that I've made in the office in my memoir. This is something that's clearly stuck in his mind as an important enough moment to be recorded in this book.
Yeah, I mean, if you are...
No, go ahead. You can finish your point, Reem, of course.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, if you are right, Emma, and this is something that he genuinely did consider, then I think you are right. Those are the only two options. It's effectively, he's either absolutely mad or he is lying. I think he is lying. I think this was probably a very casual joke that was made, and it ends up in his memoirs because he thought it was funny and it would make the front pages of the papers, which it has.
Front page of the Times tomorrow, tuition fees to rise but grants return too, is the headline. I'll read from the story. Tuition fees will rise in line with inflation and maintenance grants will be restored for the poor students under government plans to bolster the finances of struggling universities. Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, said the value of the £9,250 a year tuition fee had been eroded because it had not risen in a very long time. The system was the worst of all worlds, and she wanted to change it as soon as possible. And the Times has been told, I read in the paper, that plans drawn up by officials would mean fees, which have been frozen since 2017, rising by 13.5% over the next 5 years to 10.5 grand. Reem.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, especially considering the fact that in 2019, Keir Starmer ran the election effectively on the basis that, well, one of the manifesto promises was that they would completely scrap tuition fees. So to now be in the position where they want to actually raise them, I think is really interesting. Yep. Just from my personal perspective, I don't think that tuition fees should ever be scrapped. I think it's completely unfair for effectively a Tesco shelf stacker to be paying taxes towards my university degree. I think that's unfair. They don't benefit from it. So I don't think that university should be free. However, this, you know, the political point really is that this sort of comes throughout a whole new swathe of different policies where it feels as though Starmer and the Labour Party are no longer, quote unquote, for the working people. Again, that's a political point. I don't believe it to be true necessarily.
Well, surely you don't know until the budget.
Oh, absolutely. We don't know until the budget, but effectively what Starmer and Reeves are clearly preparing the public for are tax rises. And in my opinion, you cannot, well, I think factually, you cannot raise that £22 billion that is apparently a black hole within public services. You cannot raise that in tax revenue without hurting working people, without increasing taxes on working people. I just don't think that's true. I think it's entirely for the birds. And so if it is true that they...
If there's a windfall tax, which there would be, on a further windfall tax, a further take on some of the big power companies. If they did hit the non-doms hard, if they did hit the pensions of the people who are paying the additional rate of tax, in other words, they earn over 150 grand a year, they're paying 45%
tax. Yeah,
there are
plenty of ways to raise it without raising income tax, VAT, or national insurance, which is the taxes.
But that's the difference.
What's been speculated is they're going to hit CGT, capital gains tax. So for those people, it's a relatively small amount of people in the country, but they could hit that. They could hit pensions. Now, if they hit pensions, Emma, that's going to be controversial depending on whose pensions they hit and how they hit them.
Yeah, there are some proposals out there to tax much, much higher paying pensions than most of us will ever know or live with. which could raise significantly more. I think if they were to do that, they would probably have to balance that with scrapping the idea of the means testing the winter fuel allowance to balance it out, so you're not just hitting or, you know, or not focusing all of your measures on older people. And actually, taxing the higher rates of pensions would be a much more equitable way of doing it, because it wouldn't have the cliff edge that people have been talking about in terms of winter fuel allowance.
So can I just kind of say that I think there is a difference between on tax specifically. There is a huge difference between the impact of a tax, which is what you're both talking about, the fact that only the wealthiest in society would be paying, for example, an increase in capital gains tax. There's a difference between the impact of tax and the incidence of tax. The incidence of tax is who actually ultimately pays for that. So, for example, VAT, or sort of sales tax, consumption taxes officially are paid for by businesses. But we all know that the incidence of that, the people that really pay for it, are consumers. Now, of course, the Labour government before the election said that they weren't going to raise taxes like VAT, and they promised that they weren't going to increase income tax. We've got to be very clear about this. If we want to raise significant amounts of money to the Treasury, it is absolutely impossible for those particular tax rises to not affect loads of people that don't directly pay it. It's impossible for those taxes to effectively not hurt working people.
Whether you agree with what he's doing or not, is it political bravery? Is it guts for him to take unpopular decisions like this?
I mean, I think when it comes to tuition fees, you have two quite competing problems. The first problem is that graduates are, by definition, well-educated, sharp-elbowed generally, noisier and involved in politics. And so they tend to be at front of mind, because they are quite often the people who are, if not the MP, just simply the MPs themselves, the ones who are staffing their offices. The ones who will be hit by this are usually the 20-something-year-olds of whichever party who are the engine that make Westminster work. So you get a lot more focus on things like tuition fees than you do on things like a vast amount of funding of nursery places. But actually, for me, I think the more equitable, the more socialist thing to do is put money, far more investment into primary and secondary education than into tertiary education, which is why the tuition fees were introduced in the first place.
This was all being talked about, tuition fees, on Nikki's programme on Thursday. He asked if it's time to rethink tuition fees. Cathy from Nottingham got in touch.
I've had to financially support all three of my daughters through university for no benefit to me whatsoever. And actually, they will all be taxpayers, so they're all going to be paying into the pot. Their friends at university got the full maintenance loan, didn't have to quite struggle so much, and it's not making any difference. They're still doing the same thing. So my issue, I suppose, as a parent, I listened to Martin Lewis, obviously, and he said, don't worry about the student loan. Forget about it. Don't look at it. You're going to pay a tiny amount, and after 35 years, it'll get written off. So that's basically what I told them. Don't worry about it, because you've got to do it because you need that job.
The university I work at has undergone two voluntary exit schemes over the last 4 years. So our staff numbers have dropped significantly, and as a result, our workloads have gone up. Our main kind of financial problem is our low student intakes at the moment. But the responsibility for that in the universities is fallen onto the academic staff, not the management of the university. They turn to us and say, you have to do the marketing for your program. You have to get the students in. And if you don't get the students in, then your program might be getting cut.
My daughter's just started university and we're helping her financially. I have told her I'm going to repay her student debt in full, all three of my daughters. I can't afford it. I'm going to work for it and I'm going to repay it. How about you incentivize, if you're going to do medicine, if you're going to do banking, if you're going to do optometry or dentist, it's going to be free. Go and study. Go and try your hardest and become that, and we'll encourage you because we need it. We're importing it from other countries. We are persecuting people to come here to work for us.
Well, let's see what you think at home tonight. 0808 5909 693. is our number. If we bounce back to the Telegraph, Ali's extra £16,000 for Starmer. This is the story, Emma and Reem, that just isn't really going away at the moment. Sir Keir Starmer has admitted that Lord Ali gave him £32,000 to pay for clothing, double what he previously declared. The Prime Minister's received clothing donations worth £10,000 in October 2023, £6,000 in February 2024, his office said yesterday. The donations were originally declared as money for his private office, but have now been recategorised. The extra £16,000, I'm reading from the newspaper, comes on top of the £16,200 that had already been declared. His disclosures will raise more questions over how close Sir Keir is to the Labour peer. Recategorised, Emma. What interesting language.
Oh, God. They have absolutely messed this one up from soup to nuts. I mean, seriously. I will defend Labour on policy terms most of the time, unless I think they're doing something wrong. I try to be, whilst obviously, as you know, I am a partisan, I try to be a genuine one. But I mean, they just keep messing this up and they need to get a grip. I think the thing with this story, and I think it was Stephen Bush who wrote this in his FT newsletter. Most of us in a job have a gifts policy of what we can and can't accept. And we know, and they're usually pretty low. And particularly in the Labour Party, a great many of our MPs have come from places like the voluntary sector where they're really strict on this stuff, like incredibly strict. Anything more than a pen and you have to declare it. Anything over about 100 quid and it's absolutely verboten. And I just think most people understand that this is not, it just wouldn't happen. If it wouldn't happen in a normal workplace, it shouldn't happen in number 10.
Is the bigger story not, can you imagine if something was declared in a workplace, having the chance, if you got caught, to quote, recategorise it? Is the bigger story here, Reem, not the language that was used, how it was initially declared? Like, getting clothes for yourself is nowhere close to money for your private office. It's nowhere close to that, is it?
I completely
agree. Is that not the bigger story?
I do think that the larger story here is actually the complete nonchalantness that is coming from so many cabinet ministers, including the Prime Minister himself. I think the fact of the matter is a lot of Labour Party politicians have been in opposition for so long and feel as though they aren't susceptible to corruption. It's fine when they do it because they're not the Tories and they've got the Tories out and things are now going to get better because they are not them. And I think that there seems to be a complete lack of awareness.
Well, it's elite complete to lack even of use strategy. The word corruption in this now. Come on.
I do think that there is an element of the fact that it smells of corruption. Now, we can't necessarily use that word specifically because, of course, we've absolutely no idea.
Well, let's not use it then.
What? Well, no, we've absolutely no idea what it is, but it's a smell of corruption. And at the exact same time, Lord Ali did get a number 10 pass. Now, the reason why I use the word corruption, Stephen, is because this is what breeds this type of corruption. It's what breeds this kind of perspective. We've absolutely no idea what it is. We've absolutely no idea what it is that Lord Ali actually received from that kind of number 10 access, that kind of direct access, which nobody else, no other Labour Lord is able to receive. I think I also just want to make the point that Starmer and the Labour government themselves have effectively completely dug themselves into this hole where they have been hypocritical. They came after Boris Johnson for his wallpaper that was paid for by a donor. They came after other Conservative members of Parliament for their spending. And yet at the very, very same time, Keir Starmer is now actually completely it feels as though they're completely unaware of the fact how bad this looks.
It goes beyond Sir Keir Starmer, doesn't it? So, gifts to the Labour Party, we've heard in recent days, Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, spoke to ITV News at the Labour Party conference about attending Wimbledon this year.
You are in a privileged position as a Member of Parliament. You will sometimes be offered the opportunity to go to events such as Wimbledon. I was invited as Education Secretary. Shadow ministers are often given similar invitations. And government ministers are often given such invitations. It was declared. I appreciate it is a privilege to be there, but I was very much there in my role as Education Secretary.
Miss Phillipson also admitted she took an offer for Taylor Swift concert tickets worth over £500.
I'll be honest, it was a hard one to turn down. I appreciate there was big demand for the tickets. It was a privilege to be there. One of my children, you know, was keen to go along. It's hard to say no if you're offered tickets in those circumstances. But it was declared. I've been clear about that. But I do recognise that, you know, I'm in a fortunate position to be able to receive it.
Another member of the Cabinet, Darren Jones, spoke to Politics Live about him going to the Taylor Swift gigs. The Chief Secretary of the Treasury got tickets and hospitality to the value of nearly £3,500 for free.
I was offered them. I had not seen my children for the election period. I thought it was a nice treat for them. I confess I'm not really a Swiftie. I went in my suit, as was well known. But I took my kids to that. It was a nice treat for them, and I declared it in the proper way. As you know from my declarations, that's the main big donation that I took, and I thought it was a nice thing to do for my kids.
Should you have taken it? I understand the premise that you've explained, but should you have taken it on the basis of what people like Rachel are saying?
It was an evening I had free when I had the kids in London. It was a nice thing for them to do.
Would you do it again?
In those circumstances, yes. I think what you have to be clear of is about the contrast between doing a nice thing for my kids, where yes, I get a perk, I'm sure I was offered them because I'm a cabinet minister, but I declared it in the proper way. There's a difference between that and when undercover journalists and leaks had to expose parties in Downing Street and corrupt COVID contracts with the donors of the Tory party. This Labour party has declared, in line with the rules, transparently, any political donations that we've received. They've explained how they've been spent. That is very, very different to the cover-ups we saw from the last Conservative government.
Of course, that's not necessarily true, because the Prime Minister did not accurately declare his clothing helpfulness from Lord Alley.
I mean, I think it's Emma. Worth just being a little bit clear on that. I mean, I am not defending it. You heard my initial answer. I am in no way saying that any of this is any good at all. What I would say about the office expenses problem, and this is something that is just fundamentally broken in Westminster. Office expenses covers everything from literally buying the coffee to paying the staff.
And well, that's incredibly convenient.
I'm not using this as an excuse. What I'm saying is that the whole system of the way that Westminster is run needs fundamental reform, because it is ridiculous. So, for example,
three and a half grand is Taylor Swift tickets, and your man is saying, well, it was a nice thing to do for his kids. What about all the other families that couldn't afford that for their kids?
Stephen, I don't know what more you want me to say, because I've said that I think it's wrong and they shouldn't do it. What I'm trying to do is expand the conversation into what needs to change, which is that the way that the whole expenses system in Westminster is dealt with is completely broken. It is not run like any business or public service anywhere else in the country or in the world. And this is a huge, huge problem, because it leads to all sorts of opaque complications. And that is true whether you are the most saintly MP in the world or if you're on the take. And it is easy for both of those people to be lumped into the same thing, because the most saintly MP in the world may have a constituency in the north of Scotland, and their expenses will be incredibly high because they're travelling to and from the north of Scotland every week. The MP on the take might have a constituency in the centre of London with very few travel expenses. And they'll be then branded on the same level of expenses, because office expenses is a stupid and opaque system.
But Emma, this is entirely separate, right?
What you're saying is that, yes, I'm not defending.
But this is about judgment.
That is the problem. Absolutely.
If you take that Taylor, Taylor Swift example, Reem, of being offered £3,500 worth of Taylor Swift tickets, and you think of the families that, you know, their children want to go to a Taylor Swift concert, and they're struggling to find the money, and they're maybe even borrowing money so that one of the kids can go, and you have a government minister deciding to treat his children because he can get it for free. Where is the judgment there, Reem?
Well, this is the exact point. I mean, I don't think that anybody has the right to go to see Taylor Swift, right? Here's the thing with dynamic pricing. It's the way the market works. If people are willing to pay more. Sorry, say that again.
I couldn't think of anything worse than going to a Taylor Swift gig, but that's a whole other story.
Well, indeed. Well, I'm quite a Taylor Swift fan. I think Taylor Swift is pretty great. What I will say is that effectively the reason why this is terrible is the only reason why those particular cabinet ministers were able to access any of this money in the first place is because of their power in government. So I do agree with Emma that the system does need changing, but there are such fundamental differences here between travel expenses and donations like this.
I absolutely fundamentally agree with you, Reem, because this is why I would like much, much more transparency so that we can understand those differences, so that we can say this is wrong, and it is wrong. I think it's daft. I think it's inept. I think they have handled it badly from start to finish, and I would like to see them handling it much, much better. But I also think that we shouldn't lose the wider point.
Let's move on. Front page of the Sun tomorrow. Phil, I was thrown under the bus. This is Philip Schofield, who's appearing in this Channel 5 Desert Island show, Castaway, isn't he? And the Sun has him front page with the headline, I was thrown under the bus. The story reads, Philip Schofield says he was thrown under the bus when he was forced to leave this morning. The presenter lets rip on his shock exit, a new Desert Island show. Schofield also aims a string of jibes at his former co-host Holly Willoughby and says he will never work for ITV again. He doesn't need the money. Why is he doing it?
I just want to make the point. I think it's absolutely hilarious that one of the points he says is he would never work for ITV again. Well, I've got to say, I think that the feeling may be mutual there. Yeah. I don't think ITV would ever want him back anyway.
Yeah, I don't think they were crying out for his return, were they?
No, I don't think so.
Do you feel sorry for him? The fall from grace,
level,
do you feel sorry for him?
I feel a little sorry for him. But from what I understand of the story, he was stupid, not a criminal. And as someone who is frequently stupid, not a criminal, I would hate my stupidity to be on the front page of the newspapers day in, day out. But on the other hand, I don't think he's done himself any favours. I think there was an abuse of power that came with that stupidity. And I do, in the same way that no one is entitled to Taylor Swift tickets, no one is entitled to be the host of This Morning. If you lose your cachet with the public, your trust from the public, then you're not going to be in that kind of a public role.
I do think that's right. I also think that ultimately this entire notion that he himself is sort of this kind of emotional character, that he suffered from his mental health. I mean, I do think that point is worth making, that Emma just made, that effectively what he did was legal, but he sort of even admitted to himself that it was immoral. My problem with this, and I think that many people will agree, that effectively what he sounds like in these kind of statements, I was thrown under the bus, he's jibing at Holly Willoughby, his former co-host, it comes across as though he has absolutely no remorse. We've got to remember here, his family have gone through hell and back. The public who have watched him every single morning and absolutely adored him. You know, it feels as though he has no remorse at all, and it just comes across as bad, and ultimately, doing him many favours.
Maybe because he feels that whatever consenting relationships he was having, and there's no doubt it was consensual, then it's nobody's business.
If it's nobody's business, then why did you go onto a reality TV show to talk about it? Why are you still talking about Holly? Why are you still talking about how you would never work for ITV? I mean, if he really did, if that was right, Stephen, if he really did want people to stop talking about it and he really wanted people to say, hold on, this actually is none of our business, then my God, he would not go on Castaway.
He seems very unself-aware. Like, kvetching about Holly Willoughby, like, what have we found out about Holly Willoughby and what she's been through in the last year? That feels kind of gross. Like, she's been through hell and back since their relationship broke down. If I were him, I'd just have had the good grace to shut the hell up.
It's a genius move, is it not, by Channel 5? We're all talking about it. Lots of people are going to watch it.
I remember when Castaway had sweet young kids on it. So, and I think that's a shame that they're not, that they're now doing has-been celebrities, but then I suppose all shows go that way in the end.
All reality TV shows end up that way. I do think, Stephen, you are right. This is absolutely excellent marketing for Castaway, because I would have never considered watching it. But now that these kind of stories, they're revealing themselves and they're ending up on the front page of The Sun, I mean, I might consider sparing a minute or two.
No, I would only watch it if they got Gordon the Gopher on it. He clearly has no regard for his former co-stars.
Will you watch it?
Me, no. God, no.
I
watch enough crappy reality telly.
I very likely won't, purely just because I don't have the time. But I do understand why people would, especially after hearing about this. I mean, effectively, we want to think about this. He'd been the co-host of Good Morning Britain for so long. And so many people, I think, also feel a little bit sort of betrayed by him. I mean, again, his kind of personality, the relationship that him and Holly had, the kind of hilariousness, the kind of joking, the kind of laughter. There are so many clips of that, and it really is quite sad. I suspect there'll probably be quite a lot of former This Morning viewers, or indeed former viewers of Philip and Holly, that might watch the programme just to kind of attempt to figure out what happened.
Reem and Emma, thank you very much. That was the paper review for tonight. Let's move on. Next, UK's last coal-fired electricity plant is set to shut down next week. It'll mark the end of 140 years of coal power in Britain. The closure in Ratcliffe and Soar, Nottinghamshire, will make the UK the first G7 member to completely phase out coal from its electricity production. I've been speaking to BBC reporter Esme Stallard about why the plant is closing.
So this is actually part of a national strategy to try and reduce the UK's reliance on fossil fuels. So coal is the dirtiest of the fossil fuels. It produces the most greenhouse gases when we burn it for electricity. So back in 2015, the UK government committed to kind of phase the country out of using coal power by 2025. And actually, we made quite significant progress with this. And so that date was brought forward to 2024. So really, the closure of this plant is kind of a reflection of the whole country's commitment to kind of move away from using coal to produce electricity and to use cleaner power sources.
And give us a sense of the extent of this in terms of how many homes it supplied power to and what's going to happen to those homes now.
So this coal plant was the last of many coal plants across the UK. It supported about 154 workers. But actually, there's been work by the National Grid to make sure that even taking this particular plant offline, there is enough electricity to support households across the whole of the UK. And so we've been trying to, or the National Grid has been trying to kind of increase the deployment of renewable energy. So that's wind and solar, to make sure that the production of power is continuous despite the closure of this particular plant. So as of kind of within the last few years, we've actually seen now about 50% of the energy in the UK is produced from renewable energy. So we've very much moved away from the use of coal in the UK.
Well, 50% means 50% still comes from coal, right?
Well, the remaining 50% actually comes from a mixture of other fossil fuels. So mostly the UK produces the rest of its power from gas. The new Labour government came in, they really committed to making sure that by 2030, all of our electricity would be produced from clean power. So basically that means that all the power we produce in the UK won't produce any of those planet warming gases, greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide. So actually, we still produce a lot of our electricity from gas. And so to phase that out will require an increase in renewable energy, but also it will require an increase in battery storage. But that's because wind and sun doesn't always shine. So how do we make sure that we have energy all year round? Well, it's by storing that energy we produce. And so that's a really critical component of making sure that we have a green grid for 2030.
The massive cooling towers at the power station, what will happen to them?
So there's actually going to be a very long, almost 2-year process decommission this plant and also actually make sure that the site can be used for other purposes in the future. So at the moment, I mentioned that there was about 150 jobs, but actually in the future, the hope is that further low carbon energy generation can be made on site, and that actually could generate a further 7,000 jobs within the region, which is really important for the East Midlands, which is heavily relied on coal production but other industrial services. So even though it's the end of electricity generation as we know it, actually the whole site will actually have potential job creation and use in the future for supporting the grid of the UK.
Wow. So what the closure for the area then, any change is scary for any community. What will this actually mean? Is this opportunity, new opportunity for a new generation in the area?
Yeah, it is scary. And actually, in the run-up to this closure, myself and other colleagues spoke to a lot of people that have been working at the site in Ratcliffe on Soar. And there are some people that have been working there for 20, 30, 40 plus years. And they said it is a really sad day. You know, their main ambition for the whole of their careers is to make sure that this site continues to produce electricity, it continues to support the homes and the businesses of people across the region and across the UK. So it is really sad. But there are also people who've been working on the site for only a few years as apprentices, and they want to make sure there is not just kind of the legacy of this plant, but there is a future for it as well. And, you know, we've heard in just the last week that the government has committed to making sure that there are opportunities for those workers that have kind of the engineering and scientific skills to go on to work in the kind of future green jobs that we talk quite a lot about. It means things like wind and solar power. So it definitely kind of, I guess, bookends a 142 effectively year legacy this country has had in coal production. But the government hopes that actually there'll be further job creation, that people that still have a very long career ahead of them can go and work in.
And it is a big time, finally, Esme. The closure of this facility will make the UK the first G7 member to completely phase out coal from its electricity production.
It is. It's a really full circle moment, actually. The UK was the first country in the entire world to have a coal-fired power station. Back in 1882, Thomas Edison, many people will associate with the light bulb, started his first coal-fired power station in Holborn, London, and it actually powered the streetlights of London. And now we're becoming, as you said, the first major economy to kind of end that chapter. But I was speaking earlier to Lord Deben, who is the longest serving environment secretary for this country. And he said, you know, that sends a message to the entire world that the country that kind of started this almost relationship with coal is kind of bringing it to an end. And actually it demonstrates that we're kind of moving on to the next stage, which is very much a kind of cleaner, greener future using wind and using solar and relying less on the kind of most polluting fossil fuels. So it kind of feels quite, I guess, poetic in the sense that we started this journey and now we're the first to end it, I guess.
Esme, thank you very much for talking to us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
One final update to bring you. Hezbollah has just released a statement denying that any weapons or arms depots are located in the buildings that have been hit in an Israeli strike in Beirut. It comes after Israel's military said it had carried out targeted strikes on buildings it says are storing Hezbollah weapons underneath them. And that is nearly it from us for this Friday night. Thank you very much indeed once again for your company. Thanks to Anthony and Julia and Niamh for producing the show, to Sam and Paul in the studio, Harry and Leona on the phones. Paula edited tonight. Let's play out with a reminder of the warm tributes paid to Dame Maggie Smith, who has died at the age of 89. Maggie was one of Britain's best known actors with a career spanning 7 decades. Kitty Razzle looks back at her life.
Little girls, I am in the business of putting old heads on young shoulders.
Maggie Smith in the prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
I am dedicated to you in my prime.
She won an Oscar for her portrayal of a maverick teacher in 1930s Edinburgh, though with typical wry humour, she claimed it did her little good.
It's had absolutely no effect on my career whatsoever, I have to say. Because when I did get it for Best Actress, I didn't think I worked again in films for years.
In fact, she appeared in 5 films over the next 10 years and won another Oscar for California Suite, playing an actress who has been nominated for an Academy Award.
I have a definite.
hump on my left shoulder. It costs £500 and I look like Richard III. Do you notice the hump, Sydney?
Maggie Smith had already become a star as a classical actress on the stage and on TV in roles such as Portia in The Merchant of Venice.
If he lose, he makes a swan-like end fading in music.
She was versatile, even singing and dancing in Oh, What a Lovely War.
But on Saturday I'm willing, if you'll only take the shilling, to make a man of anyone.
But she had a particular genius for comedy.
I prefer acting in straight plays, but I find that comedy is much easier for me personally.
For Maggie Smith, serious acting and comedy weren't so far apart. Here she is in Alan Bennett's Talking Heads, playing the quietly desperate wife of a vicar.
The sermon was about sex. I didn't actually nod off, though I'd heard it before.
She played some of her best-loved characters in her 70s, including Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films.
Now, today we will be transforming animals into water goblets.
And in Downton Abbey, she was the Dowager Countess of Grantham, mistress of the devastating put-down.
When I'm with her, I'm reminded of the virtues of the English.
But isn't she American?
Exactly.
Of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 1 o'clock. This is Tyler Dunn. There have been further strikes on the Lebanese capital Beirut. Tensions have been escalating between Israel and the Iran-backed group Hezbollah, which is based in Lebanon. Earlier, the Israeli military launched a separate attack on what it said was the armed group's central headquarters. Israeli media reports that the target of the strike was the Hezbollah leader Hazza Nasrallah. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen is in Jerusalem.
We talk a lot about the Middle East being on the brink. It feels tonight as if they're tumbling over the edge of it. As far as Israel's concerned, they seem to believe that they have inflicted so much damage now on Hezbollah that their boot is very much on the throat of that organization. For Hezbollah, the decision is what to do with the rest of its arsenal. It is believed to have a very formidable arsenal still of missiles it could use against Israel. As Israeli pressure continues, there might be a feeling of use it or lose it.
Boris Johnson has revealed the details of plans considered during the pandemic to raid a warehouse in the Netherlands to retrieve COVID vaccines. In an extract from his memoir published in the Daily Mail, the former Prime Minister says the aim of the operation would have been to take doses created by the British firm AstraZeneca that he describes as legally ours. Mr. Johnson admits that, in his words, the whole thing was nuts. The King and Queen say they're remembering the actress Dame Maggie Smith with the fondest admiration after her death at the age of 89. She was best known for her roles in the Harry Potter films and the ITV period drama Downton Abbey. Six rare turtles that washed up on the coast of the UK have been given a lift home to the Azores by the crew of a Royal Navy warship. HMS Medway took the animals to the Portuguese archipelago as it crossed the Atlantic to join international counter-drug smuggling operations in the Caribbean. Here's Rebecca Drought.
It's thought the juvenile loggerhead turtles, who were found in March last year, were swept from the Caribbean or the eastern seaboard of the United States by strong winds and Atlantic currents. Used to warm